Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Raptors Over Everything, a podcast for Yahoo Sports Canada. I'm your host, William Liu, and joining me on the podcast this week is Michael Grange from Sportsnet. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Will. Appreciate it.
So we just came from the Nick Nurse press conference. That's after the day after Game 3. Obviously, Game 3 was sort of an emotional experience for a lot of Raptors fans. The timeline was melting down. I thought Nick Nurse just today was a lot more composed. And, you know, certainly he was getting grilled, I think, to some degree by the media. You know, what are your sort of takeaways from just Nick the morning after?
Yeah, I think Nick, one thing I have been pretty impressed by him all year is he does stay composed. He doesn't get too rattled one way or the other. And I've always kind of been curious about that from the minute he got the job, and it was clear he was determined to be himself. And I think himself is a little more irreverent maybe than your average coach, a little bit more comfortable being, I would say, more frank than most coaches in terms of
yep.
things that go wrong or go right. And that's always easy to do when things are going well and there's not a ton of pressure. And here you are, things aren't going well. And mm-hmm. right now there is a ton of pressure. And I thought he was pretty consistent the way he's been all year, and I thought some of his comments were pretty plain. It's you know, there's some issues, and if we don't fix them, we're going to get beat. But they're fixable issues. So I mean, that was sort of my takeaway. It was, you know, you can kind of read in between the lines of a few things, but it was you know, him walking the line between. Yeah, I mean, we got some problems, and B, we're just going to fix them. We're not going to panic about them.
Right. And I think, you know, if you do read between the lines, what he's trying to say is guys like, you know, Kyle and Mark in games, game three specifically, but kind of throughout the entire time that they've been teammates and sort of the way this team is structured. Obviously, game three was the worst example of this, but they end up passing up a couple shots. And I think in a playoff series where, you know, Kawhi's doing everything he can. Kawhi has been amazing. There's nothing the Sixers can even do about him. They're sending three guys at him. But, you know, when they take away Pascal, or at least limit him to the point where he's struggling and he's, you know, tripping Joel Embiid, and that's unfortunate, out of character for him for sure. Mm-hmm. But you got to go to your third guys. And the talk coming into game three was how they were going to make a couple of adjustments to get Gasol some more shots. And then when you look at the box score at the end, he has six total attempts in 29 minutes. And so I feel for Nick Nurse in that sense, because if Kyle and Mark are doing what they're doing in this series and they're not willing to shoot, and really when they shoot, they don't even score, then what can you even do as a coaching, you know, from a coaching perspective?
100%. And I mean, you know, I'm sure you saw on social media, as I did, like, you know, after game three, and, you know, people are up in arms and why didn't he do this, and there were no adjustments. You know, the standard kind of three things that people always spit out there as proof of horrible coaching. And you know, you just kind of have to look, and Gasol and Lowry are $60 million of basketball player.
Yeah.
And they made four field goals. And you know, and on the bench you had Serge Ibaka, Fred VanVleet, and Norm Powell, and you know, people are killing Nick about the rotation and this and that, but that's another $40 million of player, right? Like Serge Ibaka is not just your run of the mill off the bench big. He's not Greg Monroe. He's definitely not. But he's a $20 million player who's been an All NBA player at times and has coming off maybe the best season of his career in a lot of respects. And, you know, Fred VanVleet, everybody's hero a year ago, was sixth man of the year candidate.
Yep.
And Norm Powell, well, we've seen him do better, right? Yeah. We've seen playoff Norm. And so if you're a coach, like, it's like you're, you know, it reminds me of those, you know, it's like you're juggling knives, right? Like, okay, who is going to go out and get a job done? Who's going to go make a shot? And as he looks down that bench, once he gets, you know, presuming Pascal and Kawhi are on the floor, who's it going to be? And so there's no adjustment you can make that makes up for the fact the guys who are on the floor can't execute.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's different for younger guys. I think, like, especially if this is your first run through the playoffs, you can be overwhelmed. What's really strange about Kyle, Mark, and I guess Serge is to a great extent, because Serge has been in the playoffs every year of his career, and to see him get to this point is just, it's baffling. Like, he just forgets how to play basketball sometimes.
In the playoffs, as a Raptor, 100%.
Oh, yeah. Before this, it was great. I mean, he had so many great moments, but I think these guys understand, like, they need to do better, and I think as much as we talk about, you know, Kyle and Mark being unselfish and making high IQ plays, passing out of an open three is not a high IQ play.
That's right. No.
That's a low IQ play. And you mentioned only four field goals. Kyle for this series is at 12 points per game on 36% shooting. And Gasol is at 6.7 points on 30% shooting in three games. Kyle actually had a pretty good game too. I think they kind of wasted that a little bit, because I don't think that's norm for Kyle anymore. But, like, do you feel like at this point in their careers, it's sort of reasonable to expect them to do... I mean, I think they'll play better than this, for sure. But to expect them to be approaching 20 points a night?
Well, I don't even know if they need 20 points a night. Let's start with 12 each.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Sure. Like, sure. I mean, these... All five Sixer starters were in double figures before the third quarter was over last night.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think it has to be an explosion. You don't need one of Marc Gasol's, you know, triple doubles that he used to was, you know, he's had a few of those, and I think he had one against the Raptors maybe, but and you don't need Kyle Lowry going off for 39 like he did in game 7 against Miami. Like, that's not necessary. Mm-hmm. It's, I think the Kyle Lowry you saw in game 2 against Orlando, when he, you know, made a point of, you know, being an offensive force and a threat from the beginning. I think you need that kind of Lowry. I think you saw a little bit of that in game 2 against who were they playing?
Philly.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're in Philadelphia.
Thank you. Well, I'm in a Marriott. It could be anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what you need. You know, basically you need two players who have tons of experience and all the ability in the world to really look for their own opportunities and not be so caught up in trying to find the next perfect opportunity. You know, good is the enemy of great is one of those coaching sayings, right? And I think that's where those two guys are right now. They're trying to turn, they're trying to be too perfect, and it's hurting them. And, you know, these things are percentages. You know, they just need to turn the dial from a 7 to an 8, and all of a sudden the results are exponential.
I think what's especially curious in the case of Mark, because I think with Kyle, sometimes it's physical limitations. There's only so much he can do, right? Sometimes it's not even easy to get a good shot off. Whereas with Mark, he's 7 foot tall, and realistically, when he's playing pick and roll with Kawhi, the defense's priority is to go to Kawhi. And Mark's open, but then he'll still move the ball. And it's that part is something where if you look at sort of just the way he played in Memphis, and obviously it was different. He was like number one. 1B maybe to Mike Conley, but, you know, at worst 1B. The mentality is different, and you see the way he's shooting, the way he used to play in the playoffs. It's just, I don't think that abilities left him by any means. I just don't think that
he played like that 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly, right? So I just, it doesn't fully make sense to me. Do you think he's expending a lot of energy sort of going against Embiid, and therefore he's a little bit too tired to go on offense, or what is it? Because I think sometimes he has open shots, and he's a really good shooter.
Well, I think he shot, since coming Raptor, I think he shot about 43% from three, and a lot of those are above the break. Like, that's big boy. Those are big boy shots. And so he's clearly able, and, you know, but I think he made that point. I remember talking to him at one point during the Orlando series, and just at that point, should probably look up his numbers, but he shot the ball well against Orlando. It was a continuation of what he did in the regular season. And he was just saying, look, you know, you work on those shots, you know that, you know that you're going to be getting them, especially with the amount of attention they're sending to Kawhi and Pascal Siakam, and you got to be ready. And I don't think that anything has changed, mm-hmm. other than for whatever reason he's not pulling the trigger, and that's on him. You know, nobody's asking him to be Ray Allen. It's, you know, like we're talking 3 or 4 attempts a game, and you know, but if they're good wide open attempts, then just you turning them down is hurting your team, because the next pass is not going to create a better shot than that.
Right. I think the other main area of concern really from Game 3 was defensively. You see Embiid go off, an entirely different player. Right? And we know Embiid's capable of this. He is a superstar. But it was strange because I think he's played Gasol like 8-9 times before this, and his career high was like 16. So he doubled that.
Yep.
In 28 minutes, he had 33 points. What was a little bit, I don't know the way how you saw it from in Game 3, but I think that early foul where Gasol swipes at the ball, and I think he got ball, but I mean, it's a superstar in his own hometown. Yep. He's going to get that call sometimes. And that call so early in the game, I think it was either the first or second minute, sort of just changed the sort of tenor in which Gasol is able to be physical with a guy like Embiid. And if you're not going to be physical with him, he's going to take every single inch and just dominate you. And I think that's kind of how it went.
I think that's a good observation. I sort of saw the same thing. Because the next handful of minutes, it was all about them trying to get his second foul.
Yeah.
And Gasol trying not to pick up that foul. And was that enough for Embiid to kind of get rolling a little bit? I mean, obviously,
yeah.
Something was, but it could just be as simple. Well, as this is a guy who's coming off 2 days rest. He was sick in Game 2.
Yeah.
And, we don't know what kind of condition he was in Game 1 exactly, but I sort of thought if he was going to go off, it would be this kind of situation where you're kind of, you know, you got your legs back and you got your crowd behind you and you kind of had it handed to you a couple of games in a row. And he's too good. I mean, I just don't think it's realistic to expect that you're going to hold him to 28% shooting, which is what it was in Games 1 and 2.
It's not going to be like a Nick Vucevic sort of trajectory.
No, I mean, he's just too, you know, he's kind of uncoverable in a way. Like, you can sort of influence him and make him uncomfortable and get him to do a few silly things, but eventually he's just going to go through you and dunk it or you know. But the thing that impressed me last night that, you know, he was there. He was really active on tip-ins. Like, he was just always a handful. And then, you know, I saw some stuff on the Athletics Philadelphia site where they did some film breakdown of how they were using him in pick and roll and kind of short rolling him and things like that. And that forced Gasol to kind of play him in space. And I think some of the success Gasol has had is when he can really put a body on him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can sort of play that sort of accelerator clutch thing in the post and kind of rock him a little bit and just get into that thing. But all of a sudden, if Gasol can't feel him and he's in space and Embiid has options, he's one dribble to the rim, and that's a big problem.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think that's like that pick and roll adjustment? I think. Do you think that's sort of a reflection of the Sixers figuring something out, or do you feel like that's sort of just Embiid feeling healthier and he's more capable of doing that? Because, you know, in Games 1 and 2, he really didn't play that much pick and roll. But then if you look back on it, if he was bothered by that bad knee and if he was sort of just Game 1, it very much felt like the Sixers were feeling out the Raptors. Mm-hmm. Like, what can we actually get away with, right? And it sort of adjusted the defense and things like that. Do you feel like the defense on Embiid is going to look closer to Games 1 and 2 or closer to Game 3? Because that's...
Yeah, I think they're going to have to figure something out. And, you know, part of that is being driven by Jimmy Butler kind of been given the keys to the car more and more, and Ben Simmons kind of being marginalized. And I think a lot of credit has to go to Ben Simmons. And there's been a lot of discussion around the Sixers about, you know, who's going to shine and whose team is it is and where does he fit in along Embiid. And now you throw Jimmy Butler into the mix. And, you know, the easy expectation would be Simmons would sort of kind of pout a little bit or maybe not be engaged. And instead it's been the opposite. I think his usage is way down from the regular season, but his effectiveness is way up because he's, you know, this is a world-class potential superstar who's being content to play a role. And his role is be active on the offensive boards, chase Kawhi Leonard
not easy
anywhere he can. And the effort level, I thought, has been very, very high.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when there's opportunities in transition, take them. And so the next corollary of that is you have Jimmy Butler being able to really be a pick and roll force. And and I thought Brett Brown last night, he had a great, I mean, you know, he's the most poetic coach in the NBA. You know, but he's
real grandfatherly.
Yeah, it's like, wow. I mean, this is that's more than I asked, but thanks. Yeah. And but he had a great line about why they didn't play a lot of pick and roll in the past here in Philly, because they didn't have a point guard or a ball handler that the defenders had to go over. You could just go under. And so how do you run pick and roll when the defender's going under? It's like screening mist was his line. Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So so I think, yeah, I think somewhere the Raptors are going to have to figure out, you know, how they want to play that. And and because, you know, the number I saw was I think they had 41 points on 35 screen and roll plays, and that's a pretty good production.
Yeah, and that feels low. Just based on the feeling of the game. Do you feel like one thing that the Raptors could do, because I thought coming into the series, like, something like this was going to happen, right? I think the Raptors are kind of pretty well equipped to guard Ben Simmons. And, you know, I think eventually the ball was going to go more and more towards Jimmy Butler's hands. Do you feel like they might try to put even more on Kawhi's plate and ask him to also guard Butler as well? Because at least that way, maybe the Sixers try to run their offense a little bit differently, and then the players are all ball adjustments. If you can make a coach think differently about for 5 minutes, then you've won.
Yeah, and Brett Brown's done that, I think, to the Raptors and to Nick Nurse. I think what's super counterintuitive, and if you go back and listen to some of Nick's comments this morning, was on one hand, you have Kawhi Leonard playing, as we've seen, you know, I've wrote about it, there's been a number of people who have written about it, like Kawhi Leonard playing literally historic level playoff basketball. Like, there's
the most efficient career playoff score ever in the playoffs.
Yeah, there's all kinds of, you know, but the bottom line is it's him, Michael Jordan, and LeBron. That's the category he's in, and you can jumble the numbers and turn them out anyway, but it's pretty remarkable. And yet, if you're listening to Nick and you're kind of looking at the way the Raptors have fallen off a cliff when he's not involved, maybe the solution is, as you're saying, it's a kind of is you take a little bit off his plate offensively, put a little bit more onto his plate defensively in terms of having him maybe try and make Jimmy Butler disappear. And maybe the outcome of that is that that group who went 17-5 without Kawhi Leonard scored 117 points a game without Kawhi Leonard, and, you know, can somehow find itself.
Right.
And maybe that is where the Raptors are missing right here, because, you know, it makes no sense. I mean, the matchup maybe is not ideal for Fred and Norm and the rest, but it makes no sense that they're absolutely incompetent in the minutes that Kawhi Leonard isn't playing. Because in the games Kawhi Leonard didn't play, I was looking at it today, if you extrapolate that production, they were a 63-win team.
Yep.
They were third in the NBA in scoring and second in assists.
Yeah.
So that, and then a lot of times that was on the second night of back-to-backs, as we know. A lot of times, I mean,
they
beat Golden State that way. I mean,
Clippers.
You know, like, I'm not actually saying they're a 63-win team without Kawhi, but it was a significant sample size. Like, it's a capable group that somehow has lost its way. And maybe, you know, your idea is as good as any to help them find it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, I think it just makes sense at some point, right? Because having Kawhi guard Ben Simmons, like, there's only so much to guard with Ben Simmons. And I think coming into the series, the thought was, Kawhi made Ben Simmons turn the ball over like a million times.
That's when he's handling the ball. If Ben Simmons is not handling the ball, there's no turnovers to be made.
Exactly. What are you guarding? Like, Kawhi can. There's still some thought into it. Like, you know, Ben's not really shooting from the outside, so Kawhi can help and stuff like that. But you don't. I think you'd almost rather have him on the ball, right? And the other two best players on that team are Butler and Embiid, and you want to put your two defensive player of the year candidates to sort of guard that. And I think that just makes the most sense. But, I mean, in terms of just the Sixers, like, the bench thing is just perplexing, because on one end you have a guy like James Ennis, who, all due respect to James Ennis, that's like he's like a Corey Brewer type of player, right? He just comes in,
good?
You're right. You're not even Corey Brewer. So, you know, he's single-handedly outscoring the Raptors bench. And at some point, you know, you can sort of put it on Nurse in the sense that, okay, you don't want to put all four bench guys on at once. Of course, he's not really doing that for extended
stretches. He hasn't done it in this series much.
He's doing it for like a minute with like Jody Meeks, please buy me 1 minute. And they're like losing that minute by 6 points somehow.
Right.
Right. I just, what do you do, you know, off the bench in the sense that like, these guys, are they lost causes, or in this specific series, are they sort of just like matchup?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the matchup isn't favorable, just in terms of size, if not pedigree. But you know, the big outcry last night was like, how do you not have Kawhi Leonard on the floor to start the fourth quarter? This is after he just played 12 minutes, you know, in the third quarter, and look who he had three starters on, and look who they were your three best playmaker decision makers in Gasol, Lowry, and Siakam.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that they went 11-0 in 3 minutes with Kawhi on the bench, I mean, I don't know what a head coach is supposed to do in that situation.
I feel bad for him.
You know, so I think there is sort of a matchup thing, but I also think that there's some things those guys can do. I mean, clearly the Sixers are, you know, Brett Brown says it every chance he has. This is the best 3-point shooting team in the NBA since Gasol was added.
Right.
And so they're just running at him like missiles, right? Mm-hmm. So it's however big Ennis is, just sprinting at poor Fred VanVleet.
Oh, man.
You know, the sun's getting blocked out. So I said this to Nick Nurse today, but, you know, the value of the mid-range game, yes, we know, over an 82-game season is you can't live on it. But, you know, if Fred VanVleet's going to, you know, get run off the line, I'm not all that excited about him trying to take it to the rim with Embiid kind of camped in the paint. So, look, pump, go, pull up at 16 feet and see the ball go in for once. And, you know, I think, you know, we saw that with that Spurs-Nuggets series, you know, I think in game 6, where, you know, the Spurs anti-analytical approach, it worked great because guess what? In one game, if you're actually delivering on those shots, which we all know are possible, it looks great. And so I think the Raptors need to look at some of those options, that there's more to life than an open three or, you know, a drive to the rim. There's got to be something that's available, and you got to find it.
Yeah, and these guys are pretty good mid-range shooters. Like, Mark has made a career out of making mid-range shots.
They're all good. I mean, they're NBA players, right?
Well, yeah, so. But I mean, even by NBA standards, these guys are accomplished mid-range shooters. And, you know, even guys like Fred, who haven't taken that many, like, He can definitely get those off, and so I think it's a good suggestion. I mean, I think the case of Serge, I think, is a separate thing. I think Serge is his own question is in its own right, and I just think losing confidence in Serge. I think confidence is such a big thing for most players, but for Serge especially, it seems to be almost everything.
Yeah,
right. And because Serge really does need to get the ball in certain spots, and if he's in those spots, he's automatic. If he's not, then it's hard. He's not really an improvisational guy. Is there anything the Raptors can do in terms of maybe moving Kyle's minutes around to just help Ibaka get some more confidence early in the game? Like, for example, in game 3, you know, people were like killing Nick for about not adjusting. I think he did adjust. He took Gasol earlier. He put Serge in, you know, to sort of, you know, play around with the minutes and stuff in the rotation. And that's what everyone was asking for. But then Serge comes in, and the first shot he gets is that Danny Green, sort of behind the back, and it's in the mid range, is wide open, and he misses it. And from there, I'm just thinking, this is not going to go well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's one of these things where we wonder if the coach can tweak it and do this or that. But I do throw it back on the player. You're a $20 million player.
Yeah,
right. Your primary function as an offensive option is to be available and consistent on 16 to 18 foot jumpers.
Yeah.
You know, you got to knock them down, right? And if you can't, then the team suffers and maybe they lose. So, you know, like I guess you want to try and marry Lowry's minutes with Ibaka's a little more where you can. Of course, that effectiveness depends a little bit on Lowry being effective and aggressive too.
Yep.
You know, if you want to go way outside the box, maybe you start Serge. But again, we're now in a point where every decision is so critical that if you start going kind of radical, okay, Patrick McCaw, we need more Patrick McCaw. Yeah. Or, you know,
people haven't seen Pat McCaw play in like a month plus.
The cries for Jeremy Lin are like, are we really serious? You know, I think there's like, you know, you've got to evaluate and go, you know what, at some point, maybe you do live and die with Fred VanVleet, or you do live and die with Serge and the role he's in. And if they fail, then it's on them. And that's it's not like you're dying on principle. You're just saying these are the best people suited for the job. And if they can't get the job done, no, we're not going to win.
Yeah. And that's a good point, right? I mean, like, one of the most standout moments from last year's playoffs was Bebe making a two-minute appearance, and the Raptors, I think they got outscored minus 12.
I feel like it was 10-0, but it could have been 12-0.
It could have been 12. Regardless, it was, I seem to remember, I think it was the second quarter in game two.
Yeah, it was in end of, no, it was game four.
Game four.
In Cleveland. And it was pretty last gasp.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it was, but the Raptors are still in the game, and Bebe plays literally for the first time in a month. And yeah, they go 10-0 into halftime, and it was spectacular. Like it was
such
like
a disaster.
No, because it wasn't like just Bebe happened to be on the floor when all these bad things happened. No, it was his fault.
Yeah,
like he was the reason all those things happened.
Yeah,
you know, either a turnover or a missed shot or this whatever, and you felt for Bebe because, and it's interesting, you can sort of draw a line, probably not straight, but there is a connection between the way Nick Nurse coached this year and that moment, because a lot of what Nick Nurse, as we all know, was about this season was flexibility and getting people into unusual roles and maybe some different lineups. Much of that was forced on him by all the reasons we know. It would have been interesting had he had, you know, like last year's team, I think everyone played, every starter played, like they had seven guys play 77 games or some crazy number.
Yeah.
So it would have been interesting last year to see with that kind of continuity. First of all, the Raptors would have won 70 games. 60 something, right? Like, it would have been nuts.
Sure.
And so you wonder if he would have been as flexible with all his tools available to him. But the point is, I think Nick Nurse wants to be the kind of coach that has guys ready to, you know, spring on somebody when needed. Except guess what? As Dwayne Casey knew, it's friggin' hard to do that. Because all of a sudden, Patrick McCaw hasn't played for 5 weeks. And you're really going to play him in the most critical game of the season?
Ask him to guard Jimmy Butler.
Like, I mean,
come on.
It's that is high-risk coaching.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll get a taste of how much appetite for risk Nick Nurse has.
Right. And I think there's some things where, you know, if you're Nick Nurse and you're looking over your options, like there are certain things that are, this is something logical that could work, and there are some things that are like, if this backfires, people are going to remember it, like Bebe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think in the back of his mind, you have to do manage that. And I think, I mean, it's tough. It is strange, though, that now that I'm not sure what his specific philosophy is, but at least early in the series, sort of he felt very comfortable with sort of just pressing the advantage. It felt like even when the Sixers were bringing their bench in early in the game, he was content with saying, my starters are very good, and they're going to crush these lineups, and they're going to give us like a 10-point advantage. And at that point, I'm going to turn over to the bench, and I know they're going to sort of cough up some points. But, you know, hopefully the bet is that our bench is a little bit better than their bench. And, again, that just goes back to just the bench being so tough that anytime you put any – you replace any member of the starting five with any member of the bench, somehow it just doesn't quite work out. And it's strange to me because, you know, two guys like Fred and Serge have both spent so much time playing with the starters, and then all of a sudden they just can't do it anymore. And it's just, it just doesn't make sense.
No. And it really could be as simple as, you know, a sample size thing. Like, this is just one of those, like, we've only played three games, right?
Yeah.
And really the minutes we're talking about where the bench, you know, it's a limited number of minutes relatively. Like this whole thing where, you know, the team can't score if Kawhi Leonard's not on the floor. Well, that's only 27 minutes. Like, it's 9 minutes a game. And, you know, so it just could be we'll find out. It could be one of those things that turns around. And like Fred VanVleet had a pretty good line the other day where he just said, yeah, no, you believe in energy. There's good energy. There's bad energy. But, you know, a guy hits a couple of shots, it's all out the window. And it's true.
Everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the face.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we zoom out to the bigger picture a little bit, I think this series has been really informative in terms of just Pascal Siakam and sort of his growth as a player and the potential and everything like that. Because all year it's sort of been, wow, how much higher can the ceiling go? I remember like The first loss they had, I think it was to the Bucks, and he had like 22 points in that series, in that game. And I was thinking, wow, this is great. Look at that. What a great performance from him. And then it just 22 just became like 24, and then 26, and 30, and 35. And I think I looked it up. He had improved his scoring average. He set a new career high 7 times this year.
Right.
And all the way up to 44 points.
Right. I remember I was in Atlanta on the night of the trade deadline. Yeah. And he might have had 35 that night.
It was him and Fred were crazy.
I'm pretty sure it was the 6th time. And I remember asking the exact question, like, how many times can a guy set their career high in a single season? And he kind of, I don't know. And then like a week later, he goes off for 44. I mean, it was bananas. So, and he's done it against really good teams, too. Mm-hmm.
And he did it in the first round against Orlando. That's the thing, right? Because, you know, a player, he's never played this role ever before. It's a completely new territory for him. He goes up against Orlando, a very tough defensive club.
That defended him well.
I think he only averaged like 8 points a game against that team in the regular season. And whatever, regular season is whatever. But still, I think just on paper, they have very tough wing defenders.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a solid defensive club. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from Orlando just because the Raptors won in 5 games. But the fact that he scored like about 23 points a game and he averaged close to between 55 and 60% shooting, and you're just thinking, wow, like this is really the real deal. And then you see game one, he shoots 12 of 15 for 29 points. It just seemed like the ceiling doesn't even exist for him. But then, you kind of get checked a little bit because all of a sudden the Sixers put Joel Embiid on him. And he should probably be in consideration for Defensive Player of the Year. And he should probably win it. Based on this series, he should win it. But you do start to see the ceiling a little bit. At least that's how I see it.
And
if your ceiling is you can't score on Joel Embiid, that's like 95% of the NBA.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the guy is going to be an MVP, right? Like, right. I mean, talking about Pascal Siakam, like, you know, I don't know if he's headed to be the next Kevin Durant or
Giannis.
You know, like, there is a category of guys that are above the rest. But could he be Chris Middleton? Could he be... just go down your list of all-star type players who are contributors to elite teams.
Right.
And, you know, like, why couldn't he be what Draymond Green has been? Maybe better in some ways. I mean, there's things...
Offensively.
There's things Draymond do that are, you know, superstar in his own right, defensively and off the ball and stuff. But, he is... I think he has proven to me is... can be the number one option on a team that wins 60 games and makes it to an NBA final. I mean, that's probably a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Can he be a guy who's an all-star multiple times and is on playoff teams his entire career? And could he be on a championship team as maybe the second or third best player? Probably the third best player maybe on a championship team. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. You know,
it is amazing.
It's amazing. And I think there's... You know, I think there's still some low-hanging fruit in his game, and you've seen some of what you knew this point would come. I thought,
yeah.
In the playoffs, where that somebody would just say, you know what, we're going to take away your corner threes, we're going to sag off you and turn you into a jump shooter, and go at it, right? And I think I don't know if mentally he's maybe at the level where he can just say, you know what, fine, I'll kill you from here, right? Yep. I mean, that is a sort of a transition point because I think. To be that guy who just steps up and starts knocking down above the break threes, like, you have to be comfortable missing a lot.
Like Jimmy Butler. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that kind of confidence.
And so there's that kind of, like, you saw that in game two. Once all of a sudden he missed a couple, had to think about a couple, you know.
Yeah.
It's a tough hurdle for guys to get over. But he's been a revelation, and it's been awesome. Like, I mean, you can't – if you like basketball, you like Pascal Siakam. It's simple.
Yeah. And I think, like – a series like this, experiences like this, is going to be really informative for his career and development, right? Because, you know, you got to work off something. He's already basically not mastered, but close to mastered most of the other parts of the game. He's got the corner three. He's developed all the one-on-one moves. And, yeah, this is sort of where he has to develop as he goes on. And if the Raptors do manage to get past the Sixers, it's not going to get any easier. He's probably going to against Giannis, who's the bigger version of him.
Right.
Like, stronger, faster, longer.
Shoot as well, though.
Doesn't shoot as well, you're right. But, I mean, that's defensively. I can't even imagine how anyone would score on Giannis.
No.
And then after that, if you do go to the finals, it's like Draymond Green. So
yeah, no.
We're talking like the best of the best defenders.
Yeah,
in the world.
You're in the big leagues. But I think that Pascal Siakam is you know, it's he's one of the funnest Raptors of all time. Like I don't even know if there's an equivalent story. Right?
He's like a Pops Mensah-Bonsu who got actual basketball worked. Skills. Yeah. I was very excited for Pops. Yeah.
Good dude. Works for the Spurs now, I think.
Yeah, he's like a front office guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm happy for him. Yeah. Even bigger picture. And this is getting to that territory of Kawhi Leonard and the elephant in the room and things like that, right? Because, you know, we both mentioned that Kawhi has that great Jordan-esque run, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, only like 3 minutes, but it was Jordan-esque in that moment. LeBron-esque, I would say. And he keeps the Raptors within 7 points to start the fourth quarter. And then the rest of the guys come in, and they give up 11-0. And he sits for about, I think, 143 seconds, and all of a sudden, the game's over, right? And the Sixers are trapping him half court. During those 143 seconds, when he's watching his team sort of perform like this, what do you think is going through his mind? You know, I don't want to...
I need to get hydrated.
Actually probably how Kawhi thinks.
Like. Yeah. Like I don't think he's having existential thoughts. Like, that's one thing I'm confident in is, I'm certainly not privy to very much, but I don't think he was reading too much into anything. I think he lives his life pretty much as we see, which is what's in front of him, what's next. But at one point, the season's going to be over, and if it's over sooner than later, I'd like to say it'll make the decision one way or the other, but...
But, I mean, who knows? Even a guy like Paul George, they lose that first round series to Utah, and it looked like there's no way Paul George is leaving.
Yeah.
And then he stays.
Yeah, they had good fishing in Oklahoma City, so we like that, right? So, I mean, maybe that's the key, right, is we don't offer some... Maybe Kawhi's into surfing. We don't know about that. I don't know.
We need to know more about Kawhi's
own. Yeah, it's impossible. But I think... So I don't know what he's thinking. You know, it's fascinating, right? Like, had he kind of wanted to in San Antonio, he could have signed somebody, told me it would have been the most lucrative contract in NBA history. So not only would it have been the Supermax, mm-hmm. but because it was a no-tax state, his take-home would have been the richest single salary package in the history of the NBA. And it's not clear whether he ever actually offered that, but it's pretty clear had he wanted to stick around, they would have.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then so now your option here is to look at $190 million. And so I've always kind of thought that there's no way he's going to walk away from that much money twice. But, you know, the guy's kind of inscrutable. And, it's not even clear if, Kyle Lowry was 23. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If Pascal Siakam was 6'11", like if you had – the most optimal circumstances would even want to say. It's just, we just don't know. But I would agree that a hasty exit and, moments like you just talked about at the start of the fourth quarter, they probably don't help.
Yeah, definitely. And, if this is, I don't want to say if this is sort of like the last couple of games we see, or like this is the rest of the playoffs or what we see out of Kawhi, but I do think that as Raptors fans, like, you got to really take in and absorb this experience because, this is what they mean by superstar, elite, Hall of Fame. Like, all those adjectives, we kind of throw them around a lot now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, sure. Pascal is a superstar. Sometimes he is a superstar, but real superstars are superstars literally all the time. And we're seeing that with Kawhi, and he's had such a great run. And you just got to appreciate every single moment of it because, again, like, what did he say in the press conference? If you look at the future, you'll trip on the present or something.
Yeah.
No. Incredible. No. That should be in a college poster somewhere.
I'm sure that's where he got it. But I think it's true. Like, Vince at his peak. Like, there's been flashes of guys for portions of years, and like DeMar, people love to kill DeMar. I remember that run he had at the beginning of the season 2 years ago, and he averaged like 37 points a game for the first 10 games or something.
Like him and MJ were the only two players.
Right. Some nutty stuff. But you're right. Like, it's at moments like this when, a team, a really good defensive team with a ton of talent is helpless against you. There's like five guys in the league right now that fit into that category. And the Raptors have one of them. And, it took 25 years for him to get them. So, you got to appreciate it.
For sure. Going even bigger picture, and I'm looking at this in the sense that of like,
the moral obligations of Adam Silver? Is that how big picture we're
going? Not that big picture.
Not that big, okay.
I'm talking like the front office. You know, at some point you do change everything else. And I don't think it's fair, by the way. It's just like, oh, look, you lost to a very good team. Like, realistically, the Sixers are a very, very good team.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Losing to them shouldn't really be as sort of doom and gloom as it is. But, you know, after changing everything else, you change the coach, you change the star player, you sort of change all the role players more than once. Do you feel like any sort of heat drops comes back on Masai or anything like that? Because, and I don't think no one's going to say fire Masai because this and this. But do you think there's any heat whatsoever?
Me personally, I don't. Yeah. I think, from the minute this deal happened, it was pretty evident, right? The upside was this guy likes it. He's healthy. He sticks around. And you have a new, another five-year run. All of a sudden, you're the Dallas Mavericks. You've been in the playoffs 11, 12 years in a row, and maybe one you squeeze a championship in there somewhere. The worst-case scenario, the guy can never play for you, and you blew up your team for nothing. That didn't happen. And this is sort of the most realistic scenario. And right. I think the most reasonably optimistic scenario was the guy was healthy, had a great year, fit in well, and delivered. And your team was really, really good. And there was a few circumstances that were beyond anyone's control, be it injuries to everybody's thumb. And
there was a rash.
Four different thumb injuries.
You think McKechnie was running to Foot Locker every day to get shoelaces?
Yeah, I don't know. But, because I think we said this before. If this team was healthy, like people forget, they were 20-4 when JV went down.
Yeah.
And so if he never gets hurt or if they're just healthy the entire time, like I swear to God, this was a 67, 68, 69 win team. So in those circumstances, how can you really – you went for it, man. That's as simple as you can say it. You went for it, and if it doesn't work out, and it still could. When I say not work out because you don't get to a finals or you don't win a title, then to criticize somebody on that is fine. And you knew going in. If it got to this point and it didn't happen, well, then you're probably recalibrating anyway, and at least the decision was made for you.
Right. And I think that's the thing when you sort of break down for coaches and executives and things like that. Like, they're not physically shooting the basketball and putting it in the basket and stopping another team from scoring. Like, the best thing Nick Nurse can do is put his players in the best position to succeed. And the best thing that Masai can do is give Nick Nurse the best possible players to succeed in those moments. And I think on both fronts, you can maybe argue for a couple things with Nick, but I don't think he's like mismanaged the series by any means.
No.
And I don't think Masai has done anything to warrant it. I mean, I don't know.
If you're going to get really nitpicky, Blake Murphy had that really good story where he kind of outlined all the little nerdy moves they made that saved him about $18 million and got them out from a little bit of luxury tax. Greg Monroe being one of them, right? Like that move saved them $4 million.
Yeah.
And here it is. Did it cost them game two? Like maybe. So, but you're getting really, really kind of, I don't know. I mean, to me, those things don't outweigh a lot of the positive stuff that's happened there this year at all.
I don't know how you would blame Masai if Greg Monroe outscores Marcus Hall. At one point, you got the better player there.
You got to live with that, yeah.
Quick prediction before we talk about the piece that you wrote for on Sportsnet, which I thought was great, and I tweeted it out a couple times. But just looking ahead to the rest of the series. So the Raptors have been in this position a couple times, down 2-1 in the series. Mm-hmm. Not with this current team, but whatever, this current team still somehow gets compared to previous teams. Is this one closer to in 2017 when the Raptors lost game 3 to Milwaukee, 104-77? It was a disaster. Mm-hmm. Bucks fans, I think, chanting Bucks in 6. And the next game they came back, Raptors win. Very ugly game, but about 87-76, something like that. It was a really ugly game, but they win. Norman Powell had a great game. Or is it closer to game 3 against Cleveland where obviously LeBron last year hits that, I don't even know what to call that thing, a running bank shot, I guess. But he hits that, and then the next game they come back. They completely collapse. They lose 128-93. The last moment we ever see of DeMar in a Raptor jersey is hitting Jordan Clarkson in the head and getting ejected. Like, I can't believe that's how it ended.
Yeah, but, I mean, Jordan Clarkson. If you were going to hit one guy to end your Raptors career, he'd be the one.
Yeah. Him or Darius Smith, actually.
Yeah. There's a couple.
But which one do you feel like it's closer to?
Oh, definitely the Milwaukee thing. I mean, that was a first-round series, but you know, there's some parallels between an emerging Milwaukee team and I guess the Sixers are a little bit further ahead on the food chain. But, I remember covering that game three in Milwaukee, and the building was just super intense, and they were terrible. Like they were, that was probably the Raptors' worst game ever. They were 0-8, and he was 0-8. And then he comes back, and I played, I would say, maybe his best game ever as a Raptor. I mean, like, it was a super low-scoring game, and he went off for, I think he had 33, and had 5 assists that game, 4 steals. And I remember it's like every bucket was just like...
Yeah, it was pulling teeth. Oh, classic Raptors playoff game.
He just had to work and work. And, you know, I was kind of reflecting on that a little bit. I'd say, you know, you're pretty sure you're going to get something like DeMar out of Kawhi, but what you need in game four is something like Norm out of Norm or Fred or somebody. I mean, that was – he hit.
Well, you need something like what Norm did back in that game.
That's what I mean.
From, like, Kyle and Gasol.
Yeah, or anybody. Yeah. I mean, but that was like, – because they inserted Norm in the starting lineup for JV. But the point being, you need somebody to step up. You need somebody to make some shots and change the – you know, tilt the defense a little bit. And if you don't, you won't win.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think if the Raptors get through this, it's through defense. I think that's one of the things that I took away from that game was just the way the Raptors locked in defensively. I think some of their adjustments helped, and Jason Kidd coaching on their side, I think, helped too. But the Raptors, I mean, they locked in. And even DeMar is out there getting steals.
Yeah. No, it was
everyone follows, right?
It was an amazing game to be at because it was just, you knew. Like, this was 5 guys or 10 guys, whatever the number was, just 100% committed to doing whatever it took to win a basketball game. And it was, you know, it was pretty powerful to watch. And they went on and won the next 3.
Yeah.
So... that was one thing talking to Nick Nurse today. Like, he was really like befuddled. He's like, who were the 6 guys who played so hard in the previous 6 playoff games against Orlando and Philly? And then they didn't. Just didn't. You know, it could be as simple as that team did not play hard enough to win that game or even compete in that game. And so I think we can be 100% certain that's not going to happen again. There's no chemistry things here where these guys are trying to quit on their coach or anything stupid like that. So, you know, they got slapped, and I presume they'll come back and punch back.
Yeah, for sure. I hope so too. And hopefully they win 3 straight to win the series. That'd be great. Cool. I'd like to keep covering the Raptors. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about was your story up in Sportsnet. I think it was right before the Sixers series?
Yeah, it ran for the first time, I think, the day before, the morning of the game one. So right. Saturday morning of,
Kyle Lowry is actually a nice guy. He just doesn't care if you know it, which I think is very funny. You know, I think, first off, do you think this sort of reputation that Kyle had as sort of a difficult guy, do you feel
I think he still has it, to be honest.
Okay. But do you feel like that's something he earned, or do you feel like that was sort of a perception based on what people derived from
I think he earned it. Like, I mean, like, there's, it's tricky, right? Because why is that perception out there? Well, you know, because when he's the public face of the team, and we've all seen him do and been, I wouldn't say the victim of, and been a participant in, you know, whatever mood Kyle is in on a given day. And then you add that in with, you know, some documented things he's admitted, the way he's butt-headed with coaches. And then you add in some other stuff I've kind of heard and some stuff I've reported. And the guy is a difficult...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
At moments, he's a very difficult guy to coach. He's a very difficult guy, I think, to be around on at certain moments. And he is, and when you add in the fact that he's not overly invested in putting, you know, a cliche type smiley face out publicly all the time, you know, that's sort of who he is. He's a little bit of a curmudgeon, right?
Yeah.
He's a, and you know, so I've been around him for 7 years. I've certainly seen that side of him.
Right.
But what motivated me to do the piece is I've also kind of out of my side eye and things people will tell me, there's a completely different side to this guy.
Right.
And you hear that enough times and you observe things. It's kind of off the record observations, I would say, that you're like, okay, there's something here and maybe I'll pursue that. And it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things you really sort of talked about was his growth as a man, and mostly because, you know, the big part of that is him becoming a father multiple times and him sort of, I would say finding purpose, but sort of, you know, deriding a lot of what he currently do. And his motivation nowadays is really to be a great dad. You know, you wrote in the piece about Kyle explaining how, you know, his motivation right now is he wants that moment where he can have his kids with him on that podium. And it's such a beautiful moment. I mean, how many times are like what Steph and, you know, the Warriors, I mean, the Warriors win every championship. So whatever, they're always bringing
their kids.
It's always their kids, whatever. Yeah. I know all the Steph Curry kids or whatever. But yeah, that's kind of the moment Kyle's working towards. It's really about his kids. And I think that, that sort of maturation of playing and sort of attending to someone else is, you know, is sort of reflected in sort of his growth as a person, right? And you've covered for 7 straight years. A person has to change in 7 years,
right? And I mean, and you know, I don't think it's that big a coincidence that his son Carter is 7, turning 8.
Mm-hmm.
So really, the Raptors run and the Kyle Lowry era kind of coincides with him being a father to begin with, and then becoming a father for the second time, and all of that thing. And I think what's sort of interesting is, yeah, I mean, I'm a parent. Like, I think a lot of people, it does, there's no getting around it. It either changes you or you're a terrible parent. I mean, that's just a fact, right? So if you're the same kind of person you were before you had kids, after you had kids, then you're either very unusual or you're a crappy parent. And, you know, and I think, you know, but there's a lot of stuff. It was interesting around talking about that stuff with Kyle is, you know, first of all, I do get to see him with his kids. Like, he has them around a lot. Yeah. Like,
and the Raptors do a great job with that.
They are good. But, you know, and you can just kind of tell the way people are with their kids. Like, you know, there's a real confidence.
Yeah.
You know, like, because, and that only comes with time and stuff like that. And so that I think it's real. And then I had an interesting chat with Alvin Williams, who's known Kyle since he was a teenager.
Yeah.
And like, Alvin will tell you, like, when he first met Kyle Lowry, he thought he was an asshole. Like, he did not like him. And, you know, and it took time and it took time. And then, you know, Alvin was telling me for the story, like, when he saw Kyle become a father and how he was, there's a couple of things that jumped out. One was, when he just saw it, encountered it, it was kind of inspired him. It's like, man, this is, I can do better.
Right? Yeah.
This guy's he really has it together. And two was how generous Kyle was as a father and a friend to Alvin when he had, because Alvin's had 2 older daughters, and then he's just had a young boy, he's 2. And all of a sudden Kyle's like sending him parenting tips.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Stuff like that. And so that's where it gets to the nice guy part is, you know, is there's just enough examples I've seen and encountered where the guy's actually pretty thoughtful and pretty considerate of people in his orbit. And
you mentioned he did the same thing for Fred.
Yeah, you know, and you know, there, that whole relationship is probably worth the whole story on its own, yeah. right? But just taking him in under his wing and you know, Fred. So the interesting thing about this story is it sort of, I just kept bumping into these little anecdotes, and I thought, okay, there's something here, and you know, him going and finding the game ball for Nick Nurse yeah. after the first win, like the coach killer. This is Kyle Lowry, the yeah, coach killer, like. Yeah. You know, making the time to go find that ball and present it and
yep.
to the rookie head coach. I mean, that's pretty good.
Yep.
Or, you know, Fred saying, like, look, man, when I got rich all yeah. of a sudden and I've got to think about wills and estates and, you know, how to make sure all my finances is in order. Well, think about that.
Yeah, it's a lot.
You know? Like, who would I? I wouldn't know who to go to.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's Kyle Lowry. That's my plug.
Luckily, we'll never be rich, you know. So.
I'm still optimistic.
But, you know, he's my plug. Like, he's my yeah. guy. And I remember there's a clubhouse guy I talked to. And literally, that conversation was five, six years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I just, you know, who's the nicest guy, you know? And Kyle Lowry. I went, what?
Yeah.
Kyle Lowry? And at that point, Kyle wasn't even talking to me. And I'm like, okay, you know, so it kind of adds up, and you're all right. Maybe there's something here.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah. it's hard to sort of you know, spin a narrative about someone's life because you don't want to tell someone's story unless that's actually the story that they believe and that's the story that they want to tell. But I think that, you know, with Kyle and such a big part of sort of, and it's been written about previously. I think Jonathan Abrams for Grantland wrote about Kyle like many years back about sort of. You know, his father leaving him mm-hmm. in his formative years and how that's
Eric Green wrote about it too, actually.
Eric Green also wrote yep. about it, right? So yep. like, you know, it's a very difficult thing and it happened during his formative years and I don't think I just think that personally it's very heartwarming that he's taken that experience and he's done his very best to be the best parent that he can be
yeah.
and as available as he can be, and not even just to his kids, but just to people around him and stuff. So yeah, I mean, no. Who knows? I mean, everyone hates doing those little post-game pressers. We probably hate it doing too. My arm's always sore as hell. Like.
Yeah, it's not my it's not the favorite part of my job, but you know, and my relationship with Kyle, it's kind of funny, right? Like I remember we were in Detroit this year, and like walk in the dressing room before the game, and maybe he wasn't playing, and I'm like, hey Kyle, what's going on? I'm not playing today, Mike. I don't have to talk to you. I go, yeah, but we could just talk, right? Like we just, you know. Say hey, what's up?
Mm-hmm.
He's like, no. I go, well, why not? He says, because I'm not playing today. I'm not talking to you. I go, so you'll never talk to me unless you're actually playing. No. I go, what if I bump into you on Bloor Street? He's like, well, that'd be great. Come hug me up. That'd be all good. And I'm like, you know, that's what I mean. He's just like cantankerous, right? So it's entertaining and anyway, it was fun and he made the time for me. He wasn't, ironic, a game he wasn't playing in Minnesota at the end of the season, and
right.
he was bored as hell, and I'd been sort of trying to do the story, and we just sat down for about, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour, and he was great.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, that's a great piece.
Yeah. Seriously, thank you. I appreciate it. It's fun.
Yeah. I think the best type of storytelling is, I mean, like you can break down film and you can sort of like put X's and O's on the screen and do this and that, but like, I think, you know,
Narrative is still good,
man. Yeah. I mean, like that's the kind of stuff that like, you know, it gives you insight into who you're watching and not just like seeing these guys as sort of like, you know, robots to study, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
These are real people. And at any time that you get a sense of who these people are and how they became how they are and how they are to other people, like, I think those are the stories worth telling.
Yeah. And it's fun to do them for sure. There's no one I think that does this kind of job doesn't enjoy the opportunity. And anyway, it was, you know, I was lucky that Kyle was in a good mood that day.
Yeah. Look, it only took 7 years to get that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, well, I think that does it for the podcast. Hopefully the Raptors can do that Milwaukee series thing and finish us in six, but I'll take seven personally. I'll settle for seven. It'll be fine. It'll be fun.
Especially if it's a day game. Seven games in the game, seven at night's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, Michael, thank you for coming to the podcast.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. And, thanks everyone for listening to Raps with Everything. And I'll be back after game four to react to what is hopefully a very jubilant win.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.